the city of Naples, that their proverb is, "See Naples and die." As if once you've seen that bay and that architecture and that city, you've seen the best that earth has to offer. There's nothing more to see. Leisure and Travel Magazine does not list Naples in its top 15 cities to live in currently. The top three are San Miguel, Mexico, Chiang Mai, Thailand, and Charleston, South Carolina. But Florence, Italy, and Rome, Italy do make the top 15. And two other American cities, Savannah, Georgia, and New Orleans, made the top 15. There are some great cities on earth. We live in a great part of the world, and most of us probably would not exchange living here for somewhere else, even one of those top 15 cities in the world. But this morning's class begins with a question. Can I interest you in some real estate in New Jerusalem? For there is a city that's better than Jacksonville, Alabama, than Naples, or Charleston, or any of the cities that men live in on earth, because this is a city not built by men, but built by God. John saw this city represented in Revelation 21. He saw New Jerusalem come descend out of heaven as a bride adorned for her husband, Revelation 21, 2. And then he describes the city in figurative language beginning in verse 10. And we're going to look at this description today, not only of what it means, that is what the words say, but also what these words imply to us, what we might see the Lord is holding out as a motivation for us to want to live in His city, in New Jerusalem. So let's just dive right in. Revelation chapter 21, beginning of verse 10. Let's observe first that he describes the exterior of the city. Imagine, if you will, and it might not be hard for most of us, going to a realtor. Maybe sometime back you went to a realtor even here in Jacksonville. Maybe you received a job opportunity, decided you would move here. You needed a place to live, so you contacted one of our realtors and you went around and you saw these different houses that were available for purchase. And as you drive up into a property, to a community, the realtor is going to be telling you some of the positive things about this property. He's going to say some things maybe on the way over there about Jacksonville. Might say, you know, this city has good schools. It's convenient. The roads are not too crowded except during class change time for JSU students. But other than that, you can get around. It's a nice place to live, low crime rate. So a realtor is going to tell you about the positive things of the city. Imagine visiting New Jerusalem and having an angel, perhaps, show you around the city and show you some of the highlights of the city. Perhaps the first thing as you arrive would be, let me show you the exterior of the city. Let me show you what you will see first before we get into the actual mansion where you will live. Beginning of verse 10, He carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain. So John, in this vision, has a good vantage point above, looking down into the city so that he could see what is being described here. And showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. And her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. Now verse 12, the exterior. And had a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Let's stop there and observe first that there's a wall around the city. In ancient times, cities generally had walls. They had them for three purposes. One was to define the city. This city property that will be defended by its king or leader, it starts here at this wall and everything inside is protected. It was defining. It also was for the purpose of enclosure. It would keep the citizens together, what we call today urban sprawl, where the cities just seem to go on and on in a very unattractive way. Well, a city wall would keep them enclosed in a certain area. And also, in those days, they had a lot of animals. And that would also serve as an enclosure, at least an exterior enclosure for the animals that the inhabitants of the city had. And the third reason, and the most important reason that walls were built was for security or defense. Because in those days, the attackers were going to come on the ground level, and they were going to come straight at a city or from somewhere in the from one of the approaches to the city, and a wall would limit their opportunity to injure or to capture the inhabitants of the city. And that would also make it much easier to defend because they could defend the gates, and then they could defend from on top of the wall, which gave them an advantage to an army that was approaching below them. Always higher ground is advantageous in battle. And so on a wall, protected was a much easier way to defend a city than at ground level. Now here we find that heaven has a wall. It has, you could say that it is a gated community. Gated communities are popular in our day, especially in large cities with high crime rates. My first experience with a gated community was when I was living in Montgomery and going to school at Faulkner, and Brother and Sister Winkler lived in a gated community. They invited us Bible majors over one time for a visit, and so we sat in their living room and talked shop about Bibles and books. But I remember the first time I'd ever gone through a gate to get to somebody's house that had a guard that stopped you and found out who you were and made sure you had a place to go in the city. Well, that was for security purposes. Heaven is a gated community. It has a wall around it. And that wall would serve two purposes. It would serve the first purpose of security. That's the implication of it. We will be secure in heaven. It also served the purpose of restriction. The implication or the lesson to be learned from it is that heaven is not just somewhere you can just show up at. You just wander in. You just accidentally get there. No, you don't accidentally get into the city of New Jerusalem. You go through a gate to get there. You have an angel posted at every gate. You have permission to be in that city. People do not just end up there accidentally or because they have brute force strength to be able to go there. No, they won't be able to enter heaven because it has a wall. The wall is described as being tall. 72 yards, if you took a football field and stood it on end, about 72 yards up would be the top of the wall. That would be a tremendously high wall, 216 feet. Now, by comparison of the size of the city, as we'll see later in the reading, 1,500 miles wide and long and tall, it would not be very high compared to 1,500 miles tall. Yet it was high enough that no one could climb over it, high enough to be an imposing structure, and in this case to add great beauty to the city because of the description of the wall. So it was tall. It also had foundations, 12 foundations. You know, if you were going to build a doghouse, my dad used to build and sell doghouses, and I would help him sometimes. We didn't put a bottom in those. You know, those, you just set a doghouse on the ground. Dogs prefer that. And they can dig out a little bit, make it comfortable. If you're going to build a doghouse, you don't have a foundation for that. If you're going to build a shop, you might lay a block foundation, or you might just put it on treated lumber. If you're going to build a house that will last 100 years, though, you want to put it on a good foundation. And here is a wall around the city of New Jerusalem that will be the eternal city, but it doesn't just have one foundation or two. It has 12 foundations, implying strength, implying longevity, because that city will be, as mentioned, an eternal city. And then those 12 foundations are garnished with 12 different stones. Let's just continue the reading here. Drop down to, we'll come back to 13, but look at 14. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them the name of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So you notice the gates had the names of the tribes of Israel from the Old Testament, and the foundations have the names of the apostles from the New Testament. And connecting the two, you see that heaven is the eternal abode of all of God's people from Old Testament and New Testament. There's a joining, there are a merging of the covenants of the patriarchs and then Moses and then the Christian dispensations. You also observe as we continue to read, verse 15, "And he that talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city and the gates thereof and the wall thereof, and the city lieth foursquare, and the length is as large as the breadth, and he measured the city with the reed 12,000 furlongs." Probably about 600 feet each, that would make it about 600 each, and then about 1,500, as we mentioned, altogether. There's some discussion about that, but that seems to be the strongest. "The length and the breadth and the height of it are equal," so it's a cube. "And he measured the wall thereof 140 and 4 cubits according to the measure of a man," that is, of the angel, "and the building of the wall of it," and the building of the wall of it was of jasper. "And the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third a chalcedony, the fourth an emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth a topaz, the tenth chrysophrasus, the 11th a jacinth, the 12th an amethyst." 12 foundations. You know, foundations is something that we don't put a lot of time in garnishing or trying to make attractive. If you've built a house or you've seen a building being constructed, you know, it may have some very ornate features eventually, the interior finishings, the exterior of the building that you see, but people do not put any money in the foundation beyond what is just necessary. You know, they don't paint it. They don't put any extra expensive materials that aren't necessary for the strength of the holding up the building. But here you have the foundations of the wall are garnished with all these precious stones. The most precious things on earth here, on earth, up there, just are what you walk on and what garnishes the foundations of the wall that's made of crystal or of diamond. Those stones are roughly equivalent to the high priest in the Old Testament who had a breastplate that had precious stones on it. And these are not exactly the same stones, but very close. The reference to that would be Exodus 28, 17 through 20. Now, we mentioned that the city wall would indicate limited access. Let's go back and touch on that. We've seen a description of it, but now let's talk about the meaning of it. The Bible says, Jesus records Jesus saying, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." I don't know exactly how everything will work out, but we could imagine it being like this, with the angel posted at the gate of the city of Jerusalem asking for a password when we get there. What's the password? Here comes a man up and he says, "You know, I was very generous on earth. I was very helpful. I built buildings for universities and I spent time helping children. And you know, I used my money for philanthropic opportunities." Angel shakes his head. That's not the password. Here comes another who will say, "You know, I was honorable on the earth. I was an elected official. I was recognized in my community with many awards. I lived among the elite." And the angel shakes his head. No, honor on earth is not the password to get into heaven. Here another approaches and says, "I lived a good life. I mean, I was good to my neighbor and I resisted the temptations to be immoral and to do things that would hurt others, and I was a good person." Angel shakes his head. No, that's morality's not the password to get into heaven. What's the password? John 14, 6. Jesus is the password to get into heaven. "I am the way, the truth, and life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." But does it just mean that we acknowledge Him, that we somehow say, yes, I believe Jesus existed 2,000 years ago. Yes, I acknowledge that He is the Savior of the world. Or is there more to it than that? Jesus also said in Matthew 7, 21 and 23, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, that is, acknowledges me, knows the password, in other words, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. You see, it doesn't just mean we acknowledge Him academically or mentally, but it means that we submit to Him. We look to Him as Lord and King and not just as Savior and friend. It means that we're willing to say, speak, Lord, thy servant heareth. Command, and I will obey. I will bow my will to your will, and I will submit to what you think is better, even if it contradicts with what I think is better. Acts 4 and 12 says, and neither is there salvation in any other, for there's none other name under heaven given among men that can save but Jesus. That's the name that saves. You might also put down 1 John 2:23 and 2 John 1:9 on that point. Now let's move on and talk about not only the wall, which we've seen is restrictive, but the wall has gates, and gates are opportunities to enter. You know, a wall around a city would not be very valuable if it did not have access points. Because either you were in or you were out, and no one could leave or no one could enter. This city of God, New Jerusalem, has access points. It has 12 gates. They are described as being made of a single pearl. I suppose that a gate made, like the foundation, seemed perhaps to be made of small stones garnished side by side by side. I guess you could interpret it that they were of a single stone of chalcedony or whatever that went all the way down the foundation. But it's specifically said on the pearl that it was not made up of many pearls that make up each gate, but just a single pearl, 12 of them in all, tremendously large and tremendously beautiful. Pearls have long been valued on earth. I read where Julius Caesar paid 125,000 crowns for a single large pearl. The government of Holland is said to have possessed, perhaps it's still in the crown jewels, a pearl that's larger than a pear. Pearls are deemed worthy of value on earth, and the city gates of heaven are made of lustrous pearl. Now we observe that these gates give us access into heaven. Jesus did not come to earth so that only a few could go to heaven, so that only the Jews, for instance, could go to heaven, but the Gentiles are going to lose out, or so that the elect, as some men teach, a small percentage, can go to heaven, but nobody else. No, when Jesus came, He said, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned. Mark 16, 15 and 16. Jesus said, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. Matthew 11 and 28. You see it also in Acts 17 and 27. You see it also again in Isaiah 55, 6 and 7. And I want to touch on this 12 gates for a minute. If you had one gate, and in a sense, the Bible does talk about there being one way to heaven. That's Jesus. We touched on that. Matthew 7, 13 and 14, hearing ye in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leadeth unto destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way that leadeth unto heaven. So the Bible does use that. This is a different figure from that, though. That's emphasizing the previous point of the restriction of going through Jesus and His way to get to heaven. But the gates around the city being 12 in number indicates access for all people. It indicates because it is north, south, east, and west, which was verse 13 that we skipped, on the east 3 gates, north 3 gates, south 3 gates, and west 3 gates. No one has a favored position to get to heaven. Now, in a sense, we were born into a country that has freedoms for the gospel to be preached and for us to hear it without interruption or intimidation. But God would just as soon have someone from the east instead of the west come to heaven in three gates on that side of the world, or from the north as from the south. And I guess it depends on where your vantage point is, where you might view the north, the south, the east, or the west. Perhaps from heaven's vantage point, you just look at the globe and you divide it into four quarters, or you divide it in some way, and each one of those, you could say, has equal access to come to heaven. And that's the reason that we're to take the gospel to all the world. You could say that the western gates are more crowded in our generation than the eastern gates, although that seems to be switching to some degree now as we can go into some of the eastern former Soviet bloc nations and preach, and people are obeying the gospel there now. You might say that more obey the gospel from the northern hemisphere than the southern, or from the southern to the northern. Some gates more crowded than others. But what this is teaching us is that God is not more interested in one kind of people or one section of the world. He wants everyone to have access. And you may remember from studying in the Old Testament, Numbers 35, some other passages, that when the children of Israel settled in Canaan, it was decreed by God that there would be cities called refuge cities. They had laws under Moses that said if you killed someone, for instance, you were out cutting down trees with someone, your axe head slipped off of the handle and hit your partner and killed him. Well, the Redeemer, the avenger of blood, relative to him, usually a father or brother, could take your life for that. Life for a life, a tooth for a tooth, a limb for a limb. That was the law. But if that happened, you could immediately, before the avenger of blood knew about it or could catch up to you, you could flee to one of these cities of refuge. And there, the case would eventually be tried, and you might still be punished if it was deemed that you did it on purpose. But if it was deemed that it was an accident, then you could live in that city and be protected for the rest of your days or until the death of the high priest. And then you could go back home. I said all that just to say, do you remember that there were six of them? Three on the east side of the Jordan River, three on the north, on the west side of the Jordan River. And they were equally dispersed from north to south. And the Israelites say, I read that, and Israelites said that you would never more than a half day's journey, no matter where you dwelt in the land, from a city of refuge. There was equal opportunity. You know, if you were up in the far north and the city of refuge was Jerusalem, that wasn't one of the cities of refuge, but just for illustration's sake, you had to get to Jerusalem. Well, you know, that's a long trek, and you got to cross the river, and he might easily catch up to you before you got to the asylum. So God made sure that there was one up in the north on your side of the river and in the middle and in the south. So that's parallel to what you're seeing here with the three gates on all the walls, so that God is giving the message that he wants all men to be saved. 1 Timothy 2 verse 4, 2 Peter 3 verse 9, and gives all an equal opportunity. This is also similar to John 10:16, which says, Jesus said, I have other sheep which are not of this fold. So the Jews had the mindset of, we're God's chosen people. Jesus is preparing them for the fact that gospel is going to be different. The gospel, I have sheep that are not in the Jewish fold. It's also similar in Matthew 8 verse 11, we shall sit down with, they shall come from the east and the west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom. So it's not just one direction. In John 12:32, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me. Numbers 35:11, if you're taking notes or for the audio, Deuteronomy 19:2-6, speaking of those refuge cities. One other point on this, and we'll move on to the next one. When Jesus said in John 14:1-3, I go to prepare a place for you. Sometimes we preach it like this, and I've done this, and I think it makes an interesting point that Jesus, the carpenter of Nazareth, has gone back to heaven to build a mansion for us to live in. And I think that's not a terrible thing to say or an application of that scripture, but the primary thing that it's saying is not he went up there to build heaven for us. I mean, Jesus built the whole universe in 6 days, right? And rested on the seventh. Does he really need 2,000 years to build heaven for us to finally arrive? No, he doesn't need that. But why is he delayed? Why is he waiting? Well, the answer to that is 2 Peter 3, 6 through 9. He's waiting for us to fill heaven up. I mean, there's plenty of space there, but there aren't plenty of people going there yet. And the longer he waits, the more people he wants us to reach so that more of those mansions, I don't know if you could picture a long street with all these mansions on it, and right now maybe only a third of them could be filled with Christians. And he's waiting so that we could fill up the next one and the next one and the next one and the next one and a whole street with our mission work and with our personal evangelism as we reach out into our community, state, nation, and to the countries, nations of the world. All right, let's move on and talk about another point now. Let's go back into this section. We've looked at the exterior of the city and the lessons we learned from that. Can I interest you in some real estate in New Jerusalem? Let's talk about the interior of the city. First, it's on a good street. You know, if you were going to buy a property here, maybe you're looking for a house now, and the realtor turns down a street, and on the end of it is the property you'll be looking at. Listen, I just want to point out, this is a really nice street. It's recently been refinished. It's wide enough so that it won't be difficult to get in and out, even if traffic is approaching. And this is a nice part of town where this street is. Well, the angel might say that to us. It's a nice street. I might point out that it's made out of gold. I might point out how beautifully it shines. We've made that part of the description of heaven famous in our hymnals. A lot of songs talk about the streets of gold. But I think that the lesson to be learned here might be this. Well, there's an old joke that you might have heard about a man that arrived at heaven's, at one of those gates, and he had a suitcase with him. And the angel stopped him and said, "Well, what's in the suitcase?" And he opened it up, and he had gold bars in it. He said, "I brought my gold." And the angel laughed and said, "Asphalt? You brought asphalt up here? That's what we paved the streets with in heaven." Now the lesson is, the most valuable thing on earth is just something you walk on in heaven. So lustrous, so luxurious, that best things we have are... It's a lot like when Solomon was king, 1 Kings 10, 11, in that section. You know, he was fabulously wealthy. In 1 year, he brought in 666 talents of gold, for instance, that 1 Kings 10 says. And at the beginning, his treasurers, his bean counters, were keeping up with all the things that were coming in, and they just gave up on the silver. They kept counting the gold, but there was so much silver they couldn't keep up. It was just like the gravel of the Jerusalem, of the city. It's just like the streets. It was just, we can't keep up. That's the way heaven is. Gold is just, there's so much of it, we just pave the streets with it here. See how beautiful that city will be. Let's talk about another one. So, it's a gated community. It's on a good street. Now let's talk about a third idea that we see in this text. There will be good neighbors. You know, here you could have a mansion. You could have a valuable house. But if you have bad neighbors, you'd probably sell that property undervalued. I mean, you've got someone who plays loud music at all hours of the night and shoots off firecrackers and you can't, or fireworks, and you can't sleep there. Or maybe they don't keep up their property and it's all grown up and junked up and it's not attractive and it's an eyesore that you have to go by to get to your house. You know, bad neighbors can limit the appreciation of good property. But in heaven, or I might say this one, if you have criminal neighbors, you know, you things go missing all the time from your property and you know who's doing it. It's the guy right down the street. if you feel threatened, don't feel comfortable letting your children go out and play in the front or the backyard, well, it doesn't really matter how valuable the property is. If you got bad neighbors, it's not a good place to live. But heaven's not like that. Good neighbors in heaven. Well, for one thing, you got the angels who are there. Luke 15, 6, 7, and 10. Let's turn over to Matthew. I mentioned this passage, but I'd like for you to read it and contemplate it a little more. Matthew 8. Hebrews 11, 16 also, we're going to be there with the patriarchs who look for a city whose builder and maker is God. They found it, and they found the same city that we're looking for. But here in Matthew 8, Jesus says, this is when He healed the centurions, beginning up at verse 5. There was a centurion, my servant is homesick, grievously tormented, I will come and heal him. You know that, probably know that, are familiar with that. Jesus healed him. And he was impressed that the man had so much faith. He was a centurion, a Roman, not a Jew. And he said, Lord, you don't need to come to my house. Just say it. Just stand right where you are and say the words and my servant will be healed. That was great faith. And Jesus marveled at it. Verse 10, when Jesus heard it, he marveled and said unto them that followed, verily I say to you, I have not found so great faith. No, not in Israel. Sometimes you find things in unexpected places. Faith in the heart of a Roman was an unexpected place, and Jesus marveled at it. Now, verse 11, and I say unto you that many shall come from the east and west and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the children of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the Jewish mindset was all the Jews get to go to heaven, all the Gentiles are lost. Jesus said, no. The way it's really going to be is, some of those people who are Gentiles are going to be saved, and some of the Jews who, and some of those people who are Jews are going to be lost. It's not cut and dried like that. Now, you and I are thankful for that probably because we probably fall in the other category of Gentile that we can go to heaven. But I said that to highlight the fact that we get to sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I love to contemplate this sometimes, to get to meet the heroes of the Bible. You know, We've read about them so much, we've preached on them or heard them preached on so often, you really feel like you know these characters, although you never laid eyes on them, never personally met them. But don't you feel like you know Paul pretty well? I mean, we've studied Paul so many times, you understand how he thinks and writes and what he did. You feel like you understand David pretty well, we can relate to him in some ways, a great man that had flaws, and other characters. Can you imagine? I've used this illustration or application before, walking down that street of gold. Now we know this is figurative language, but that's the way it's presented to us. I don't know if they have mailboxes there, you know, but here's a mailbox and the name of the inhabitant of this mansion on the way to yours down the street. Well, look, there's where David lives. There's Abraham's house. Can you believe I'm next door to Moses? I'm across the street from Nathaniel. Or, you know, fill in the... You know, these characters are not just fictional, not just there for moral purposes. These are real people with skin on that you're reading about in the Bible. Just as real as the person that stares back at you from the mirror as you shave your face or put on your makeup in the morning. And we're going to meet them. They're not gone. They're gone from the earth, but they're still alive to God. The Mount of Transfiguration, Moses came, he had been gone 1,500 years, but he's still alive. Elijah had been gone 750 years or so. He's still alive on the other side. We'll get to meet them. You will have good neighbors in heaven. And won't that be a blessing? Not only the famous people of the Bible, but good neighbors in the sense that everybody who's there is a believer in God. Everyone who's there has been faithful and is being rewarded for the life that they lived here. Excuse me. Let's talk about another one. It's well lighted. You would not want to live in a city that didn't have any lights, would you? 26,000 people this week were out of power for a while. Maybe you were in that number. If you live in Piedmont, you probably were definitely in that number for a few hours, or I don't know how long it lasted. Was that an inconvenience to you? Did you feel like, I don't know if it was during the day or the night, I think it was maybe in the morning, but if it was at night, would you feel safe without any lights? You wouldn't want to live in a place with no lights. But heaven is well lit. Not with the sun, not with the moon. You don't have those anymore. They're gone. But God and the Lamb are the lights thereof. When you think about Jesus when He was on the earth, let's just take the Lamb. He said, I am the light of the world. John 8:12. But He was muted here. Maybe the time that comes closest to showing the light of the world is at Mount Transfiguration when Peter, James, and John out on that mountain got to see Him when the mask came off just for a minute. And His face shone as the sun. His clothes were so white. It was white. Luke calls it glistering. One of the accounts says, as no fuller on earth can whiten them. Nobody could get them that clean or that bright. And they woke up and saw Him shining with brightness. The light of the world was really bright. Well, in heaven, Jesus will not be wearing His earthly mask or His disguise, as it were. He will be in full bloom or full blossom. There will be many things to see in heaven. We'll talk about some of those the next hour. We've talked about some already. Won't it be something to see those jewels and the pearl gates and the walls made of crystal? There'll be a lot of beautiful things to see, but the best thing to see in heaven is to look upon the face of the One who died for you. That will be the glory of heaven. I don't know that I can relate to, maybe the mothers in here can relate to this better, what it would have been like to look upon the face of baby Jesus in that manger for the first time. What would it have been like to have seen Jesus smile? Luke 10:21 says He rejoiced in spirit. To see His face beam with joy. Wouldn't that have been something to see? What would it have been like to see Jesus as the Man of Sorrows? To see Him cry over sin or over Jerusalem when He wept over that city. I read something interesting this week. John 8:57 says his enemies are arguing with Him. He says, I am. And they knew that was a description of God. They said, You're not yet 50 years old, and hast thou seen Abraham? Have you ever thought about why they picked 50 years old? He was 30 or 29. He was right around 30. They didn't say, thou art not yet 35 years old. You're not yet 40 years old. You're not yet 45. No, they picked 50. I don't know that you could make a strong argument for this, but the book that I was reading on the source said maybe the cares that Jesus had taken on, the Man of Sorrow who took our griefs and our problems, maybe it aged Him so that He looked older than His 30 years. I don't know if that's the case, but would it have been interesting to see His face as He began His public ministry and as He ended it. Have you ever observed when the presidents go into office how much younger they look than when they come out 4 years or 8 years later? It ages them, doesn't it? It's a lot of pressure. I don't know that that point could be made with Jesus, but the point is, wouldn't you want to see the face of the Man of Sorrows? What would it have been like to see His face in agony on the cross? Maybe the sweat breaking out on His brow as He struggles with the agonizing, indescribable pain of being crucified. What would it have been like to have been there when Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus took His body off the cross and to see His face pale in death? You know, He lost most of the blood of His body. I'm sure His face would have been pale by this point. what would it have been like to have been one of those who saw Him on the other side of the grave as the resurrected Lord, to look on that face, or to have been in that crowd that watched His face, watched Him as He ascended from earth back to heaven. The last people that got to see Him, besides one born out of due season, Saul of Tarsus, as He went up to see that face the last time. We didn't get to be in any of that number, but we will get to see His face, the face of the one who lights heaven. I remember reading about William Gladstone when he was prime minister prime minister in England. That there were those who would cross the Atlantic just to look on His face. I don't think I would have been in that number, but there is a face that I want to see. In Revelation 22:3, it says, we will look upon His face, the one who lights up heaven. And then, I'll just give this one to you without description. It has plenty of room, 1,500 miles in every direction. That's roughly the size of the eastern half of the United States, but is up 396,000 stories, allowing 20 feet per story. The implication there is there's plenty of room in heaven. You won't be cramped, nor will there ever be a time when heaven is full and nobody else could go until the Lord comes back. And then last, heaven is a place with no crime, Revelation 21:27. There are no murders there. There are no burglaries there. There are no embezzlements there. You can go down the list of the crimes that are reported every night on the news, and none of them will be there, for no one can get there who practices those things, and the devil and his tempters can't reach us, anyone there. So there will be no deadbolts on the doors, no locks on the windows, no alarms to set before you go to sleep at night. Can I interest you in some real estate in New Jerusalem? Let's bow together as we close. Our Father, we're very thankful this morning to be able to have this description of the place that's in store for us. Help us to be faithful. Help us to live in such a way, not that we would deserve it, but that by Thy grace we might hear those words, well done, good and faithful servant. In Jesus' name, amen.